that this was coming down the pike. They've just been very secretive about when they were going to do it.
A new bankruptcy filing will affect dozens of Alaska sex abuse cases. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 18th of February. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, just 2 minutes separated the Yukon Quest leaders into Dawson.
Basically what happened is the dog team took a break just before Dawson. That's the only reason I caught him up and finished here first.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. It's never too early to set expectations and goals for your child's education. The UA College Savings Plan provides opportunities that can help you reach your educational savings goals. Save in Alaska, study anywhere. There's more information available by calling 1-888-4 and then Alaska. This message sponsored by the UA College Savings Plan.
A series of previously sealed motions and closed-door hearings have been revealed in the Ted Stevens case. The former senator was convicted in October of lying on financial disclosure forms. In the weeks after his conviction, FBI agent Chad Joy sent a letter to the Justice Department claiming a fellow agent and prosecutors acted unethically before and during the trial. The Joy complaint added fuel to Stevens' lawyers' call for a new trial or an acquittal and led to a flurry of closed-door hearings and sealed filings in December. Judge Emmett Sullivan, who presided over the trial, decided to make them public last week. The filings show that the Justice Department was trying to keep the Joy complaint from going public and said it was unrelated to Stevens' guilty verdict delivered by a jury in October. They also said Agent Joy's criticisms are inaccurate and bring up issues that the court already dealt with. They said Joy was actually responsible for one thing he complains about, sending a witness back to Alaska from Washington without notifying the defense lawyers. However, Stevens' attorneys argued that they needed to see the complaint and make it public in order to use it to fight his conviction. Stevens' lawyer Rob Carey said it contained information vital to his case, such as allegations that an FBI agent had an inappropriate relationship with the government's star witness and that prosecutors intentionally hid a witness and FBI forms. Carey calls the complaint a bombshell and says they need to litigate it in the sunlight, not behind closed doors. Judge Emmett Sullivan decided at the time to allow Stevens' lawyers to see the complaint, but only made a heavily redacted version public. However, just a few weeks later, the judge became irate when Justice Department lawyers said, despite their initial protests, they wanted the complaint made public after all. Sullivan is still upset at the Justice Department and has repeatedly demanded to know who in the office knew about the complaint at what point. This week, the team of government lawyers was replaced for the rest of the post-trial proceedings. More than 60 lawsuits alleging sex abuse by priests in Alaska are on hold after the Jesuits of the Oregon province filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection yesterday.
Those cases are dead. They're stayed. They're not going anywhere.
Ken Rosa is an Anchorage attorney representing many of the abuse victims. There are about 200 known claimants in the five western states, including Alaska, covered by the Oregon province. Three quarters are from Alaska. Rosa expects many more claimants to come forward.
By the time this is over, it wouldn't surprise me to see that number double. And these all will, of course, involve childhood molestation by Jesuit priests or brothers or people who were being supervised by Jesuit priests and brothers.
Rosa was planning to file 40 more lawsuits on behalf of abuse victims next week. He says now those cases will be filed as claims as part of the bankruptcy proceedings. The Society of Jesus Oregon Province isn't talking publicly about the bankruptcy filing. In a statement released yesterday, the Society says it believes Chapter 11 reorganization is the only way all the claimants can receive a fair settlement. The Society says it has less than $5 million in assets, but liabilities of nearly $62 million. Ken Rosa says those figures will be a major point of contention during the bankruptcy proceedings.
There will be debates about whether the Jesuits own the universities and high schools, whether those universities and high schools are assets that can be held accountable or used to pay the claims. All of that will be argued before the bankruptcy judge in litigation there.
Rosa says it may take a few years to resolve the bankruptcy case, but for most of the victims, that will be faster than having their cases argued in state court. Despite an overall 2008 revenue decline for national and international air cargo carriers, Alaska Airlines proved the exception. The airline's air cargo division not only showed a fourth quarter profit, but last year set an overall revenue record. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Alaska Airlines Vice President of Cargo, Joe Sprague, exhibits a cautious pride in last year's accomplishment.
The notable achievement was crossing the $100 million milestone for the first time in the history of our company. And so that was encouraging.
In 2008, Alaska Airlines recorded $103 million in air freight revenues, with about $4 million coming from its regional partner, Horizon Air. Overall, the airline employs about 400 workers in its cargo division. Between 150 to 200 are in Alaska. Sprague says within the company, the cargo division is viewed as an important, if not crucial, unit of Alaska Airlines' financial and even community service success.
That's because our service in the state of Alaska, Alaska Airlines' overall service in the state of Alaska, is just critical to the company overall. And a big part of what makes our service within the state of Alaska successful is the cargo component and the ability to fly both passengers as well as freight and mail into so many of the communities, and certainly those over a dozen communities that we serve in the state of Alaska that have no road access.
Mail comprises between one-third to a half of the airline's cargo in the state. Sprague says much of that is in a form unique to roadless Alaska, namely bypass mail.
Shippers can actually ship stuff using postal rates, but actually bypass the post office and have those shipments go straight to an air carrier for shipment from Anchorage out to the bush locations. It makes mail that much heavier of a percentage of the total cargo volume that gets shipped, and it's an absolutely critical component of what we do.
Bypass mail for the airline was up in 2008. That was a good thing, because not all categories were.
The other challenge that we faced in 2008 that was very directly tied to the state of Alaska was relatively poor salmon returns. In Alaska, air cargo generates a good bit of activity through the summer months and other times of the year as well through the shipment of fresh seafood. And starting with a very disappointing Copper River salmon return in May of 2008 and continuing through much of the year, our seafood totals were far below what they have been in previous years.
And of course, there were also the very high mid-year fuel prices soaking up 2008 revenues. As for 2009,
we're struggling now with declining freight volumes tied to the softening economy in the lower 48 and to a lesser degree in the state of Alaska. So it was a good 2008. We'll have our hands full to get back to that same threshold again, though, in 2009.
Sprague remains optimistic. He sees the acquisition of more efficient 737-400 passenger freight combis, along with cargo-specific business systems, as giving the cargo division of Alaska Airlines its strongest foundation ever, one he hopes will help the airline weather any economic rough stretches lying ahead in 2009. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
It's unclear when work on the Tulsa Kwachief mine will resume. An indefinite suspension was announced yesterday on construction for the lead, copper, zinc, silver, and gold mine. It's located about 45 miles northeast of Juneau on the Tulsaqua River in Canada, a tributary of the Taku River. Mine developer Red Fern Resources and parent company Redcore Ventures announced a temporary three-week suspension just before the holidays as they tried to acquire more financing. But the new long-term suspension appears to come on the heels of dramatic increases in the estimated time and cost to reopen the mine. The project is controversial in the Juneau area because of possible acid mine drainage flowing into the salmon-rich Taku River. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new book recounts the state's history, bringing back the fisheries.
The runs the state inherited were in terrible shape. In 1959, the entire year's catch from the whole state was 300 million pounds of fish.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska State Elks Association, committed to eliminating the use and abuse of illegal drugs in support of a drug-free environment. Information at alaskastateelks.org. And by
TeleAlaska, a telecommunications company proud to support public broadcasting, sharing the spirit of communications across the Great Land. Voice, data, and Wi-Fi technologies at TeleAlaska, on the web at telealaska.com.
The Palin administration late this afternoon gave legislators a list of reductions to next year's budget in response to expected low revenues next year. The new plan reduces state expenditures by $334 million from the operating budget that goes into effect July 1st. But federal money will replace $73 million of the cuts in state expenditures. The new figures are based on an anticipated $2.1 billion less in revenue than was projected in December. An amended revenue forecast shows oil will average $57.78 per barrel. That's down from a projection of $74 a barrel made in December. Members of the state Senate today discussed their pending pay change, which goes into effect if they take no action on the findings made last month by the State Officers Compensation Commission. Commission Chairman Rick Halford told the informal caucus meeting that they should not be embarrassed by the increase in their basic pay.
You know, you sit across the table from some of the most single-minded, toughest resource industries on the face of the earth. And you are the board of directors of one of the great resource corporations on the face of the earth. For you to be unarmed in terms of just the ability to stay long enough and be involved.
At the top of the pay spectrum, the commission recommended that legislators' annual pay be capped at $50,400. That is an increase from the current base of $24,012. But the new structure would eliminate any long-term per diem expenses that members can now collect, a supplement that has occasionally increased some legislative pay to more than $90,000 per year. Halford said, from a personal perspective, he doesn't think the proposal is high enough.
The world has changed. We want and we love the concept of a citizen legislature. And yet we have huge changes in conflict of interest, limitations on the other things that you can do to make a living and support a family. At the same time, we have massive increases in constituent expectations of your time in special sessions and so forth. So the percentage of your salary, I think, should be based on the time commitment, but it should be a real understanding of the time commitment, not our wish that we didn't have to spend that amount of time.
The legislative salary has changed often since statehood. It reached a high of $46,800 in the mid-80s and was cut to the current $24,000 in 1991. Quest veteran William Cleeden of Carcross, Yukon Territory, arrived first at the Quest's halfway point at Dawson City last night at 10:15 Yukon time. He wins 4 ounces of gold. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, this year's Yukon Quest is shaping up to be a close competition.
Race watchers have been speculating all day Tuesday about how the front runners in this year's Yukon Quest would shake out at the halfway point. With 9 experienced mushers traveling relatively close together over a remote 200-mile stretch of trail, it remained uncertain who it was when the first dog team trotted into downtown Dawson City last night. The arrival of William Cleeden was a surprise because John Little had been reported running first about 25 miles outside town earlier in the evening. But it was Cleeden, the wily veteran, searching for a long-eluded victory in his 12th quest, crossing under the halfway banner first. As quickly as officials checked him in, a second headlamp appeared as Little arrived 2 minutes later. Cleeden says he passed a little just outside town.
Basically what happened is the dog team took a break just before Dawson. That's the only reason I caught him up and finished here first.
Cleeden says he'd ridden up on Little's team several times earlier in the day, but refused to pass until Little's dog stopped on the Klondike River. He says the pass was amicable, but a little sad.
He gave me a pat on the shoulder, whatever. It's no big deal. I felt sad for him, you know. It must be very discouraging to have your team when they can see the lights of town. I mean, obviously, you're practically in town, and they won't go further. Then you must have misjudged something in your team.
Quest mushers take a mandatory 36-hour rest in Dawson. KWC reporter Dan Bross is trying to catch a bit of rest in Dawson, too. He says this morning he was able to talk with John Little about why he lost the lead heading into Dawson.
John said that his dogs did not crash, as some folks have been portraying it, but that last night on the way in, about just a couple miles outside of Dawson, where he was in the lead, his leaders pulled over to the side of the trail, and they were eating some snow. So he stopped and was going to check and see if maybe he needed to change out a leader. And at that point, William Cleeden came up from behind and went right around him. He said he didn't know William was right there that close. And so he let him go and started his team again, but couldn't quite close the gap. So Cleeden made it to Dawson 2 minutes ahead of him.
I can't imagine how disappointed he must have been to have missed the gold prize by 2 minutes. What did he say? How disappointed was he?
Well, you could see it in his eyes that, it was tough on him. He said to me this morning that, I started thinking about the fact that I would have some gold to give to my wife as a gift. And he said to see that slip away was hard, but he said that more importantly, he's maintaining a long perspective, and that is that he's still very in this race. I mean, he's technically in the lead, even though Cleeden arrived in Dawson first and got the halfway gold prize. If you calculate out the staggered start, John Little will actually get to leave Dawson tomorrow 16 minutes ahead of William Cleeden.
So there's a bit of a silver lining in the loss of gold, in other words.
I guess so. And John Little is he's still optimistic. He's positive. He says his dogs are looking good, and he's maintaining this philosophy. He really believes that dogs can run longer and rest shorter than conventional wisdom.
Are the lead mushers still on such a record pace?
They are. They're running a little bit faster. I mean, as of last night and the top team's arrival in Dawson, they're running a little bit faster than Lance Mackey did a couple of years ago. So, it is record pace.
So, Dan, describe this lead group of mushers. What's your best guess as to what could happen in the second half of the race?
Well, for sure it's going to be exciting because you've got mushers 1 through 6, William Cleeden, John Little, Hugh Neff, Hans Gott, Sebastian Schnula, and Brent Sass. They're all Yukon Quest veterans. They've all placed fairly high in the race before. There's one three-time past champion in Hans Gott. So we got some guys who know the trail and are going to really go at it here in the second half. The thing that could change is that so far in this Yukon Quest, the weather has been relatively tame. I mean, temperatures down to maybe 30 below zero, but the trail has been fairly good, a little bit soft in sections, but generally good. Now, as they enter the second half, you never know what can happen on the Yukon River. Reports are that the jumble ice is very rough again in sections, particularly along the Eagle portion of the trail, the village of Eagle, where the Yukon passes there. The jumble ice is supposed to be rough. So that can bang up teams. And if you lose a couple of key dogs that get injured in there, that could totally throw your race.
It sounds as if they'll be facing some quite different trail conditions than once they cross into Alaska.
Yeah, the Alaska side is always a little bit rougher, just because you're dealing with a section of the Yukon that does get a lot of jumble ice. And also, the trail on the Alaska side is put in by volunteers, whereas on the Canadian side, the Canadian Rangers military group, it's really a job for them, and they put a whole lot of time into setting that trail. Whereas on the Alaska side, they rely on volunteers this year. They do have a Alaska side trail coordinator and former Quest champion John Schandelmeyer. He's been organizing the volunteers to make sure that there's a better route than there was last year, where the trail was really, really very, very rough on the Alaska side, and there was heavy complaints from mushers following the race.
Okay, well, thanks, Dan. We appreciate the update.
You're welcome.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Fishery stocks for most species continue to be strong under state management, according to staff reports heard yesterday at the Alaska Board of Fisheries meeting, which continues today in Sitka. The 2008 sockeye run on the Setuk River near Yakutat was one exception. Sockeye returns there were the lowest seen since 1960. Most of the fish runs in the Yakutat area come from the Setuk River. Pink salmon are another stock that have been at historic high levels in the past two decades, but saw declines in some areas last year. Andy Piston is a fish and game fisheries biologist from Ketchikan.
Over the last 10 years, pink salmon have made up about 71% of the salmon harvested in southeast Alaska by numbers of fish, and that's been about 47 million fish per year over the last decade.
Board member Bill Brown questioned the sudden decline in pink salmon and asked Piston if it's possible to distinguish a cycle from a trend. Piston said the stocks could have been affected by a hot, dry summer in 2004.
When those fish spawned, their progeny went out in 2005 into really warm ocean conditions, and that fish that went to sea in 2005, we saw really poor survivals, not only for pink salmon, but also for three ocean sockeye that returned this year, some of the three ocean chum salmon that returned this year. So they certainly experienced some anomalous ocean conditions also.
The Board of Fish and Game released a new book on the history of Alaska's fisheries at this week's meeting. It's called Sustaining Alaska's Fisheries, 50 Years of Statehood. Historian Bob King wrote the book. He's now working as a legislative assistant to Senator Mark Begich in Washington, D.C. King says he relished the chance to talk to all the players who helped establish the new state's fisheries management system. He says fishing played a vital role in Alaska's push for statehood.
Because it was the largest industry at the time, it was totally wrapped up in the statehood movement. And the symbol, of course, were fish traps, these huge devices that harvested a large portion of the salmon throughout the state, but took jobs away from Alaskans. And it was resentment of fish traps that really inspired a lot of the statehood movement. It was one of those issues that the average person during Territory Days could really grab onto. So it really helped drive the movement towards Alaska statehood.
And what kind of shape were Alaska's fisheries in 50 years ago?
Pretty bad. The runs the state inherited were in terrible shape. In 1959, the entire year's catch, entire year's production from the whole state was 300 million pounds of fish. And that was almost all salmon and herring, and it was worth $25 million. It was the worst run in the century. But as they started to take control, things turned around. It took a long time, but Alaskans started taking control as early as 1949 when they created the Fish Board, which for the first time gave Alaskans a say in how fisheries were managed. When statehood took effect, they revamped the federal system of management with one that was based on science and sustained yield. It allowed local control where local fishery managers could make decisions on openings and closings without having to go back to Washington or Juneau. They started a system of hatcheries to help rebuild the salmon runs and boost production. They took sometimes controversial actions that were deemed necessary at the time, things like limited entry to stem the influx of outside boats and put a limit on the number of participants in the fishery, not only to conserve the runs, but also to make it the fishery economically viable for the participants.
Andy Anderson was the state's first commissioner of fish and game. What role did he play in helping to bring back the fish runs?
Andy was a real inspirational leader. When Bill Egan took over as the first governor of the state, he ordered Andy to... He told him to rebuild the salmon runs no matter what it took. And Andy took that charge to heart. He told his biologists, he brought them into a meeting and told them that if they allowed an overescapement and put too many fish up the river, they could expect to be criticized by the fishermen whose pocket that came out of. But if they allowed an underescapement, he said, gentlemen, if you put too many fish on the spawning grounds, you can expect to be fired. I don't know if he ever fired anybody, actually, for that, but it gave a very clear message that he was really serious about what they did. And his biologists took that to heart. But there's so many other people. There was a bush pilot from Naknek who turned out to be a terrible stream surveyor for the department because he was always thinking about politics and the welfare of the young state. A guy named Jay Hammond, who Alaskans got to know pretty well better. And the biologists who were pulled right out of college for the adventure of a lifetime and built a management system from scratch. Guys like Steve Pinoyer, who was thrown out onto the Yukon River, where he didn't have an office other than the backseat of a Cessna. Guy Powell, who goes out to Kodiak with his scuba gear and does really some first research on the biology of king crabs. Hal Geiger, a biometrician, who when the department admin department refused to let him buy a computer, he bought one of his own, this bulky K-Pro 2 in a metal box that looked like Darth Vader's lunchbox.
So, Bob, lots of people love fish stories. Did you hear some that really stand out when you were researching the book?
Yeah, there are so many different fish stories. But I think, you know, the best fish story of them all is just to contrast, you know, the state of Alaska's fisheries, where they were before statehood and where they stand today. And admittedly, not everything is rosy out there. There's some huge controversies, to be sure, like fishery rationalization. There are conflicts always between different user groups. There are concerns over bycatch and other issues. But most importantly, there's a process, a public process, to work these issues out. And while, you know, I think the state has done a real admirable job on managing towards sustainability, there have been failures. King crab crashed in 1983, still hasn't recovered in many off Kodiak and other parts of the state. Prince William Sound herring crashed after Exxon Valdez. They've never come back. So there are challenges that do remain.
Do you think, in general, the state's fishery management system has been a model for other parts of the world?
It has been called that, and I believe for good reason. National Geographic magazine recently listed Alaska's fisheries as Alaska is one of the three well-managed fishery regions in the world, the other two being Iceland and New Zealand. And it's because of the state system that Andy Anderson put in. You know, you go around the world and other places, they're just stunned to know that, like, an average fisherman can go into a meeting and actually have a say and have put in a proposal before the fish board and have it seriously considered. Other parts of the world, it just doesn't operate that way.
Bob King is the author of Sustaining Alaska's Fisheries, 50 Years of Statehood, a new publication from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, Matt Miller in Juneau, Dan Bross on the Yukon Quest Trail, and Bonnie Sue Hitchcock in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is our vice president for media production. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. It's never too early to set expectations and goals for your child's education. The UA College Savings Plan provides opportunities that can help you reach your educational savings goals. Save in Alaska, study anywhere. There's more information available by calling 1-888-4 and then Alaska. This message sponsored by the UA College Savings Plan.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.